are listening pretty late, and I'm your host, Patty Vasquez. I'm in the Allstate Showcase studio, and today is December 7th, 1941 was the year that Pearl Harbor was attacked. An armada of 354 Japanese warplanes, supported by aircraft carriers, destroyers, and midget submarines, launched a surprise attack on the United States, killing 2,403 people and forcing the United States into the Second World War. On the phone with us right now is Craig Nelson, who is the author of Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness, and his book delivers all the terror, chaos, violence, tragedy, and heroism of that day. Hi, Craig. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. I'm on hour 19 of the Pearl Harbor Marathon of interviews, so you are my finale, and I'm glad to have it with you.
Oh, well, I almost wish I knew what they had already asked you. Is there something, as you said, all the hours that you've been talking about this, is there something that hasn't come up? Because I know that people kind of have an idea. They've seen the movie. You know, we're getting so far away from it now. We're losing our veterans who served in World War II every single day. Is there something you haven't covered today that you would like people to know?
Well, I guess what people should really know is, for all this gossip about Franklin Roosevelt and about who knew what where,
yes,
there were only two actual warnings about Pearl Harbor that specifically said Hawaii is going to be attacked. And the first one happened almost a year ahead of time, in January 1941, when the ambassador of Peru to Japan told the ambassador of the United States to Japan that he had heard from multiple sources that if the relationship between Tokyo and Washington goes south, then Tokyo was going to attack Pearl Harbor. And the reason why this is so interesting is that a lot of Peruvians at that time worked in Japan as cleaners and maids and nannies and gardeners and this kind of service personnel. So it's very possible that multiple sources went from the Navy to the Peruvian embassy and that they knew what they were talking about. But of course, everyone in America ignored that warning, because who believes anything an ambassador tells you, right? So, but the other great warning happened in August 1941, when a character named Dusan Popov, who was a triple agent — he worked simultaneously for the intelligence agencies of the Yugoslavs, the British, and the Nazis — appeared at the FBI headquarters. And Popov won. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm gasping because I had not heard about Popov. Carry on.
Well, Popov was such a character. He was very good looking. He was a real ladies' man. He's one of the major figures that Ian Fleming used to create James Bond.
Right.
And Popov appears at J. Edgar Hoover's office and tells him that he has a terrible warning to give him, that he's been hired by the Nazis to assess American defense capabilities. And of the 3-page questionnaire he's been given to fill out, a full third of it is about Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
But J. Edgar Hoover does not believe him, because he doesn't think he can trust a triple agent, and he knows that Popov is having an affair with the married French superstar Simone Simon, who you know from the movie Cat People. So he doesn't believe it and will not pass on the warning. And those are the only two clear-cut warnings we received about Pearl Harbor.
Well, when you say that people talk about whether or not the United States knew, whether or not Roosevelt knew, you know, people have these theories that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to bring the United States into World War II because, you know, we were isolationists. We were trying to take care of our own, you know, situation, which was trying to come out of the Great Depression. Are those the kind of rumors that you say that you're alluding to, that people have?
Exactly. And all of those rumors were begun by Roosevelt's sworn enemies. It was begun in 1944 by a guy who helped found the America First Committee, which you'll remember as the super isolationist, super right-wing committee that Charles Lindbergh joined and made a lot of anti-Semitic comments about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it was amplified by husband Kimmel was the head of the fleet in Hawaii. One of his lawyers, during one of the congressional investigations, then amplified this idea that Roosevelt knew and was involved and that it happened. And then the third person to pick it up was someone who was trying to take all the blame off the Navy and place it on the state government. So these three people sort of colluded to tarnish Roosevelt, who was dead and couldn't defend himself.
Well, why would the Navy want to take some blame off of themselves? It was a surprise attack. Was the assumption that they should have known or been better prepared?
Yeah, the Navy cracked. The Navy messed up big time. They're charged with protecting the United States. They did not. husband Kimmel was supposed to protect the United States soil with his 43,000 servicemen at Pearl Harbor. He did not. So, yes, it was a horrible stain on the service, and the people who wanted to look for someone to scapegoat it on wanted to pin it on civilians. Let me just explain to you one way to understand this point.
Please.
And that is that husband Kimmel and Hawaii received 56 pages of warnings from Washington about Japan. He then received more warnings from his own staff, one of which said that the Japanese would send aircraft carriers from the north arriving at dawn, which is exactly what happened. He then received further warnings from British intelligence in the Pacific in Asia, telling him Japan was on the loose. He said he was told he should put up torpedo nets around his battleships, and he said, I don't need to because torpedoes won't work in the shallow water of Pearl Harbor. Then the British attacked the Italians at Taranto in waters exactly as shallow as Pearl Harbor, which he knew about, and he still did nothing. And finally, he gave a war warning, which meant he was supposed to lift anchor and set sail, and he was supposed to increase surveillance, and he did nothing. And so the conspiracy theory is that Roosevelt deliberately withheld three or four additional warnings from Kimmel. And if Kimmel had had those three or four additional warnings out of the 80 he'd already gotten, then things would be different. That's how absurd that theory is.
Well, so was Kimmel the one that wanted the United States to be in war with the world?
Well, Kimmel was so had such a racist attitude about the Japanese that it couldn't occur to him that they were capable of doing this.
Wow.
And he was sort of like this stuck-in-the-past kind of person. He thought that war would be declared and that he would send his battleships out, and he and the Japanese would have a big battle on the high seas, and whoever had the biggest battleships in the best position would win the war. And that's what was going to happen. And he couldn't imagine that they could send aircraft carriers and they would have all these warplanes and they would show up in the middle of the night and they would cross the Pacific undetected, and they would use state-of-the-art torpedoes and bombs and have all this technology that, frankly, America didn't even have yet.
Well, can you explain to our audience, too, for some people, again, who maybe have learned this, you know, in the background, maybe in high school and watching movies, what was Japan's goal in attacking the United States at Pearl Harbor?
Beginning in the January 1941, Japan planned the most audacious military takeover and invasion in world history. They were going to take over all of Southeast Asia from Siberia in the north to what's now Pakistan in the west, and they would control every single thing in between, except for they didn't succeed at Thailand, but they took over all of Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Malaysia, Indonesia, all of coastal China. They already had Korea, so they had every single thing stretching along that coastline, and it took them 6 months to do it, and they did it. And the only opposing force that stood in their way was the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. So that was a very sideline battle for them. They wanted to take out that fleet so it couldn't interfere with their conquest plans. But also, there was a crazy idea underlying all this, where Isoroku Yamamoto, the admiral who planned Pearl Harbor, did it because he thought if he devastated the Americans in Hawaii, the American citizen would say, oh, we give up. You can have Asia. You're obviously too powerful for us to fight. We'll just let you have what you want in Asia. And that was his strategy. And, of course, we know what happened. And he knew Americans very well. He learned English by reading biographies of his great hero, Abraham Lincoln. So it's strange that he came up with this crazy idea because, as we all know, Americans love justice.
And, well, yes, I think that that's definitely something where, you know, Americans were obviously immediately sort of rallied into this need to wreak vengeance.
Yeah, we've tracked down every single aircraft that took part in the attack on Pearl Harbor and sank all of them. And then when we captured Yamamoto's flags. We assassinated him in the air. We tracked down him traveling in the South Pacific, and he was killed by American airmen. And then when we captured his flagship, we towed it out to Bikini Island and used it for target practice for hydrogen bombs. We really know how to do vengeance.
Vengeance. I know thy name. But now, is this quote his? He's the one that Yamamoto said, "I fear all we have done is to awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." That seems to have been the case.
Well, this is a fantastic story about that quote, because, of course, that quote is everywhere on the Internet. You can see it quoted 1,000 times. So I put it in my book, and then I needed to track down exactly where this came from and when he said it. And I finally tracked it down to, it's a made-up line from the movie Tora Tora. Actually said that. And it took me 3 days to figure out that that's what happened.
Oh, that it was a screenwriter. Great. What a great line from that screenwriter that we all now attribute to Yamamoto.
Good job, screenwriter.
that's remarkable, because what you were just saying about, you know, wanting to destroy the United States military and thinking we wouldn't do anything, basically roll over and let Japan do whatever they wanted, I was thinking this quote doesn't sound like that guy. So it turns out...
It's pretty close, because he would swing back and forth. In fact, all of the Japanese were like this. They were constantly swinging back and forth between knowing that they couldn't possibly win a war with America and knowing that they must wage war with America. It was almost like some kind of a bipolar disorder with them. And you could see it with everybody. Even the most crazy militarist like Tojo would swing back and forth in trying to decide what to do. And we have all of the documents that are in the book, Pearl Harbor from Intermediate, to show exactly this happening over time. So it's very thrilling and intense to watch the entire Japanese government swing back and forth. Are we going to do it? Are we not going to do it? And they could have canceled until the very last minute. They had it open to cancel until December 5th.
Wow, we are talking to author Craig Nelson, who's written Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. Can you hold on and do another segment with us? I know that we're the grand finale of your record-breaking day.
As long as I'm awake.
More after this on 720 WGN. I want people to understand how important Pearl Harbor is and remembering it, understanding its place in history. And on the line with us right now is author Craig Nelson, who has written Pearl Harbor, From Infamy to Greatness. And Craig, I was reading part of your bio that the America we live in today was not born on July 4th, 19. I can't do any of the numbers. July 4th, 1776, but in fact, on December 7th, 1941. Why is that? What would you tell people about the significance, the magnitude of what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Well, it's really amazing, because that's the whole reason I wrote this book. Because I think if you look at modern day America on the stage, and I don't mean apple pie and brownies a la mode America, I'm talking about at the way we appear in public, in real life, on the world stage, that we're the number one superpower, that we have the biggest military by far, that we have the most powerful weapons, that we have the most extensive State Department and foreign aid program, that we help build things like the United Nations and the World Trade Organization to settle differences amicably, and that we did all that, we rebuilt Germany and Japan, who are our enemies, back up into viable societies and two of our biggest allies. All of that sprang from Pearl Harbor. And all of that was really had one goal, which was to keep World War III from happening. And they have succeeded in doing that for 70 years. And I think that's really the Pearl Harbor legacy. And if you look at that, none of that is from, you know, July 4th. All of it's from December 7th.
And is it also our role as kind of police keepers in the world to, is that part in part to fend off World War III?
Absolutely. That's the key thing that we're trying to do. And, you know, people will say, well, why should America be the policeman? And it's because when other countries have done it, they did a really bad job. You know, for anyone who wants to complain about what America does as a superpower, I say, oh, yeah, Why don't you go ask the Indians what they thought of the British?
Right.
Why don't you go ask the Africans what they thought of the Portuguese? Why don't you ask the Jews what they thought of the Germans? You know, as the number one superpower, we may not be completely blameless and completely criticism-free, but we're a lot better than anybody else who's had this job, frankly.
Have you seen anything in the last, you know, few decades as you write the books that you have put together? And again, I'm so glad that you've written this book, Pearl Harbor, from Infamy to Greatness. A lot of stories I don't think people are familiar with. But as a historian, also, you know, your job is to kind of put in perspective. The reason it's so important is to understand how, you know, that happened then now affects us. But also sort of the warning signs of, hey, everyone pay attention. You know, we're moving in a direction that perhaps is reflective of something, mistakes that we've made in the past.
Well, one thing that I really took from the lesson of both 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, both the Japanese and bin Laden, in both cases, were sort of psychotic, and they were war criminals, and they were doing horrible things. I'm not saying this as a defense of any of their behavior. I'm saying it as something the United States could learn from both of those tragedies, is that we're very rich and we're very powerful, and we can afford to be a little bit gracious with people who aren't that way. And part of the thing that's amazing to read in the Pearl Harbor history is how our Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, is continually bullying the Japanese ambassadors and just treating them like dirt. And at one point, one of them says, well, the only reason we signed the tripartite treaty is because we thought we needed to have some friends somewhere.
Wow.
It's just sort of sad to hear what they say. And then at another point, one of the prime ministers says, please tell Mr. Roosevelt to imagine what it's like to be poor in natural resources instead of the richest country on the planet like you are. You know, I mean, it's not quite that, but it's also really like that. Blah, blah, blah. So I just think that we could be more gracious in our dealings with the poor and the weak and the scared. We can afford to do that. And we can have a lot more peaceful vibes going around. You know, I mean, every time our military does something humanitarian, we shouldn't think of it as a waste of our money. We should think of it that we have 800 military bases around the world. I want any of your listeners to imagine what it would be like to have a huge foreign government's military base in your neighborhood. Right? There would be raw messages going out. You know, things
sure.
would happen. There would be conflict. So every time our military does a big humanitarian thing, I think that erases so much ill will that just naturally builds up in conflict, that builds up friction, that builds up, that's the word I was going for,
right.
that builds up having all these bases.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the presence of military means that something could go wrong, and it also has, as you said, the vibe of conflict. So I agree. We should definitely see that as building, you know, a future for everybody rather than a waste.
Right.
That's accurate. Yeah. I did not realize, again, I told you before we came on the air that I have a degree in history, which means I know a little bit about a lot of things, but nothing specific about one thing. And I didn't realize Franklin Roosevelt's role in World War I. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Oh, this was actually one of our great finds in research. I was so happy to get this. We came across a picture, and no previous Pearl Harbor book has found this because they didn't realize. Let me explain the story. So we found a picture in 1914 during the Woodrow Wilson era of president when Franklin Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And he loved his job so much, and he just loved the United States. He probably loved the United States Navy more than he loved any single human being. And you see him at the Brooklyn Navy Yard at the laying of the Kiel, which is the official berth of ship number 39, which turns out to be the USS Arizona. And no one previously had tied together that ship 39 was the Arizona. So you get to see him, and it's 7 years before he gets polio. So he's still standing. He's holding the hand of the son of one of the ship's captains. And he's beaming with pride because Roosevelt just was crazy about the Navy from this gig as being assistant secretary. So when he was president, he's going to raise the Navy's budget every year across the Depression. He's going to have morning meetings lying in bed in his blue Navy cloak surrounded by his naval memorabilia. And he's going to call the Navy us and the Army them until General Marshall makes him cut it out. So you can see this entire wonderful story going on right in this one picture.
Oh, that is incredible. You have several stories that I had never heard. That and that the there was a teenager who shot down a warplane. Is that right? A bomber?
They tried. I don't think he actually did. There were a number of them were teenagers, actually, so maybe you're right. But the story I think you're thinking of is that a teenager tried to bring down a warplane by throwing a wrench at it. So this is how pathetic the situation was there. The Kimball had left only one boiler lit on many of the warships, which means the big guns didn't have any electricity. And even the smaller guns didn't have any electricity, so they couldn't maneuver them. So they were just sitting there, like, defenseless. And they had these little squirrel rifles called Springfields from 1903. That was the big weapon the Americans had at the time. And so there's one moment where and then the average age of the kids on Oahu, of the 43,000 servicemen on Oahu, is 19.
Right.
But the average age of the guys at Pearl Harbor and at the airfields that were destroyed by the Japanese Armada is much younger, because all of the senior officers lived in houses and apartments on nice dry land. They didn't live on the ships, and they didn't live on the airstrips in the barracks. Those were only the kids. So I think the average age of Pearl Harbor, and that's why we still got 2,000 alive, is because they were all like 16, 17, 18 years old.
Wow.
So they weren't like 40-year-old Ben Affleck. They were like, if anyone knows the Leave It to Beaver show, they were like Tony Dow. You know, really.
Wow.
They were these skinny little kids. And there's some real sad stories, too. Like a 16-year-old goes up to a commander and goes, you've got to make this stop. You've got to stop this.
Oh.
The attack.
Yeah. Thinking it was that easy. Obviously, they were under constant attack. I had heard that there were the destroyers were out at sea. They were not at Pearl Harbor. Is that right?
You mean the aircraft carriers?
The aircraft carriers.
Two of them were delivering planes to a marine stationed on Wake and Guam, and one of them is on the West Coast being spruced up.
Well, and
that's why they were away.
And that had, at least we had the two carriers, because that was significant going forward and having to rebuild the Navy.
Yeah. And the other good luck was that they missed the dry docks and they missed the tank farm. All of the petroleum for the Navy and Army had to be tanked over from the West Coast and stored in tank farms on Hawaii. And the Japanese missed those two things. And the Pacific Theater would have been delayed by like a year if they had taken out those two things, too.
What would you say, and before I let you go, what would you say as far as how our military is regarded now? Because you said that in your book that the consequences obviously continue to resonate. In addition to being peacekeepers around the world, and the world's police, what would you say the impact was of Pearl Harbor on enlistment, on the what it meant to be a serviceman or woman?
Well, it immediately turned the country onto a war footing, and the isolationist feeling that it had been taken over was completely replaced from scratch. And everyone wanted vengeance. They couldn't wait to take revenge. And they sort of, Washington was sort of a master at mixing together the Nazis and the Japanese into sort of one menace, so that we were the arsenal of democracy. We were keeping the world safe for democracy. We were stamping out global totalitarianism. And they did a sort of brilliant job of creating a unified enemy from those two groups that really had nothing in common. So it was a brilliant sort of strategy of PR in a certain way. But what I think is fantastic is that our military today is as well-trained and well-armed and sophisticated as any military ever. And I think our only thing that we have to really look out for is that we have a very big footprint and we need to sort of step lightly. I guess that was the lesson that came up to me from Pearl Harbor and 9/11.
And as we mentioned earlier, it's important to remember these lessons in order to know, at least be informed. We're going to make mistakes. That's goes without saying. But it is important to remember these things. And I want to thank Craig Nelson, who's the author of Pearl Harbor from infamy to greatness. And of course, we not only survived but thrived after World War II. And we need to continue to remember that the men and women who served in World War II and since really have an impact on people around the world. And Craig, thank you so much. What other books would you – I know that you've written quite a bit. I'm looking at this list here. You've written for Vanity Fair, The Wall Street Journal, Soldier of Fortune, Salon, National Geographic. People can find you everywhere. So my guess is just Google you.
Yeah. Well, I have a website called craignelson.us, and there's free excerpts and reviews and essays and pieces and a video of me talking and all this stuff on there. And that can lead you to buying any of my books. So craignelson.us has all this stuff about me.
Well, we look forward to having you back on the show. You are a fountain
Anytime.
Of information. Oh, wonderful. And hopefully...
Been a great time.
Oh, thank you. Hopefully it's not after a marathon of interviews. But we are so grateful for your time. And I know it's been a busy day. Thank you. Have a great holiday season.
Merry Christmas, Chicago. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas, Craig. More after this on 720 WGN.